Today is Thursday, April 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The number of worldwide COVID-19 cases is approaching 1 million, along with a sobering statistic.
The number of deaths has more than doubled in the past week.
Plus, what to tell children during the pandemic.
It's always important to tell the truth in a developmentally appropriate way. And we want to provide the kids with reassurance.
And what challenges does democracy face coming out of this crisis? Those stories and more are next. As the United States passed 5,000 coronavirus deaths, the mayor of Los Angeles, California, urged people in the country's second largest city to wear masks in public. While the U.S. federal health officials have so far not recommended that healthy people wear masks, the suggestion comes as the worldwide cases of COVID-19 approaches 1 million. World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus broke down the sobering news yesterday.
Over the past 5 weeks, we have witnessed a near exponential growth in the number of new cases, reaching almost every country, territory, and area. The number of deaths has more than doubled in the past week.
He also highlighted concerns about extra pressures felt by the poorest and most vulnerable people in areas put under lockdown orders and called for help to developing countries that may not have the resources to scale up social welfare programs. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warned on Wednesday that anyone can be a coronavirus carrier even if they weren't showing any symptoms. Italy has been the hardest hit country in terms of deaths, with more than 13,000. Its leaders announced on Wednesday an extension of lockdown orders in hopes of continuing trends of fewer new infections to control the outbreak there. The top U.S. general in South Korea says that he does not accept North Korea's claim that he has no coronavirus cases. More from VOA's Bill Gallo.
North Korea has repeatedly insisted it remains virus-free, even as the disease ravages countries around the world. However, General Robert Abrams, the head of the U.S. military in South Korea, says he doesn't believe it.
That is an impossible claim based on all of the intel that we have seen.
Abrams, who spoke to VOA and the U.S.-based cable news network CNN on Thursday in Seoul, would not say how many coronavirus cases he believes are in North Korea.
But I do know by their actions that for about 30 days in February, early March, that their military was locked down. And they took draconian measures at their border crossings and inside their formations to do exactly what everybody else is doing, which is stop the spread.
North Korea closed its borders in late January, just after the coronavirus emerged in neighboring China. Completely sealing the border with China would be almost impossible, though, since North Korea's economy relies on both formal and informal trade with China. A major outbreak could lead to a humanitarian disaster in North Korea, which lacks adequate medical supplies and infrastructure. North Korea itself has called coronavirus prevention a matter of national survival and implemented strict quarantine measures. Its state media have portrayed the efforts as 100% successful and instead highlight sprawling death tolls in other countries. With the world's focus on the coronavirus, North Korea has also been testing an unprecedented number of missiles. Last month, the country test-fired 8 short-range ballistic missiles, a record high for the country. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Infectious Diseases, stressed that social distancing efforts are beginning to slow the outbreak of coronavirus in the U.S. While the focus was earlier on old people with underlying health conditions, new data revealed by Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that nearly 40% of those hospitalized from COVID-19 are aged between 20 and 54. Dr. Talal Nsuli is a clinical professor of immunology and allergy and a research scientist at Georgetown University's International Center for Immunology Studies. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with him about the vulnerability of younger people to the virus.
First of all, let's talk about the young people that do not smoke. We are noticing that young people that are healthy and that they look like movie stars and they go to the gym, not now, but they are athletic people, they are not shielded from the coronavirus. And numerous people that are young and healthy got extremely sick with the coronavirus, and they had to be intubated, and they had to be on a ventilator, and some of them died and passed away. And they could be teenagers, they could be 30, 35 years of age. Why I'm saying that? Because we noticed that there is some type of relaxation and some type of lack of hygiene vis-a-vis the coronavirus in young people. And this is prompting these young people to catch the virus, thinking that they are shielded from the virus, and we are seeing some bad results. Of course, young people have lower rate of mortality and morbidity versus the older people, but they are still prone to have very serious disease. Now, young people that are smokers, tobacco smoke by itself weakens the immunity in the lungs, weakens the cilia from clearing the mucus and clearing the microorganism from the lungs, plus the fact that it weakens the lining of the bronchial airways, not allowing the appropriate immune cells and antibodies to attack the virus, and this can lead to a reduction in the immunity that facilitates the infection. And we know that the coronavirus is a respiratory virus that usually targets the lungs and cause major damage in the lungs. Not only a simple infection, but causes irreversible lung damage in a certain number of patients, scarring of the lungs, irreversible lung damage of the lungs, and this could be, of course, very serious. And most importantly, can lead to decreasing in oxygenation due to the fact that they go to the alveolar areas and they cause a collapse of the alveolar areas. In the alveola, usually it's at the end of the small tubes that you have in the lungs. Let's facilitate. So the lungs are like two sponges that contains tubes called bronchial airways. And at the end of them, we do have some structures called alveola in which we have exchange between the oxygen and the CO2. If these collapse, it means the patient is no longer receiving oxygen and the patient can die. And this is something that we are seeing it very frequently with the coronavirus type of reaction. So tobacco smoke has a major effect in patients that are exposed to coronavirus because automatically it has been shown that decreases the immunity in the lungs.
Are allergy patients who are known to have immune system deficiencies more vulnerable also to coronavirus infection?
Two things that I would like to differentiate. Allergy patients, more so patients that do have allergies in the lungs, call it asthma, they are, of course, more prone for the coronavirus to have problems with it. Why? Because the asthmatic inflammation by itself can already add to the inflammation caused by the infection of the virus. So if we already we have some inflammatory processes, so if already the tubes in the lungs, let's make it simple, bronchial airways, the air tubes are already inflamed and swollen with mucus. In addition to that, if we add a viral infection to it, then we have an additional factor that will cause a reduction in oxygenation and cause difficulty breathing, and this will lead to certainly a serious problem. Now, patients that do have a problem with the immune system, that have immunodeficiencies, they don't have only an allergy, but they do have also immune deficiencies. These patients are certainly at extremely high risk to acquire the coronavirus because their baseline shows that the immunity is not functioning well. This means that they are high risk for these infections and they can acquire the infection in a much easier manner. And once they acquire, they cannot fight it appropriately. And that's what we hear, that some young people or some people around 30 or 35 or 28 passed away from the coronavirus. Most likely, some of these patients did have a predisposing condition. Either they were smokers, either they had some emphysema, or they had bronchial asthma, chronic bronchitis, or they had a weak immune system. So they had some underlying diseases. So these individuals have to be extremely careful not to get exposed. They have to be extremely careful in following a specific hygiene in order for them not to get infected.
Dr. Talal Unsuli is a clinical professor of immunology and a research scientist at Georgetown University here in Washington. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. School and child care centers in countries throughout the world are closed because of the novel coronavirus. UNESCO says the closings impact more than 87% of the world's student population. Even young children know there is a virus going around, but what do you say to them? VOA's Carol Pearson has that story.
The number of children whose schools are closed because of COVID-19 is soaring, according to UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. Children are staying home, many on lockdown with their families, and they often see and hear the same information about the coronavirus that their parents do. Dr. Kate Eshelman, a psychologist at Cleveland Clinic Children's Hospital, says it's important for parents to listen to their child's concerns.
It's always important to start with the kids and find out where they're at. Ask them what they've heard, what they know, and what they think and feel about these things. It's always important to tell the truth in a developmentally appropriate way. And we want to provide the kids with reassurance.
Robert Franks is a child psychologist and president of Judge Baker Children's Center in Boston. He agrees with Eshelman.
You're not going to talk to a five-year-old the same way you would talk to a teenager. But I think it's also really important that they understand how serious this is. And it's also
Franks was part of an expert panel on Newswise, a source for journalists. Franks says it's important for parents and caretakers to remember that children take their cues from adults.
They pick up on our anxiety. They pick up on our fear. If we're watching the news 24/7 in our house, they're going to see it too, and they're going to see the way we react to it. As well as, you know, take our cues from us in terms of how seriously we're taking social distancing.
Eshelman says it's okay for children to sometimes watch the news with adults.
But if you're going to do that, do it together so that you can ask questions and address any concerns.
Eshelman says if children ask you questions and you don't know the answer, it's all right to say so. She says you can explain that this is a new situation and that none of us have been in it before. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And still to come on today's program.
In the neighborhood, I feel like a celebrity. Everybody stops me and says, "Oh, we loved your music." And I thought, wow.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. As the coronavirus pandemic grips the world, leaders are enacting special powers in this time of crisis. South Korea and Israel are using mobile tracking tools to monitor citizens to enforce social distancing and stay-at-home orders. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte told his military to shoot lockdown violators. In Hungary, a parliament granted Prime Minister Viktor Orban an open-ended right to rule by executive decree. It imposed jail terms on those hindering measures to curb the spread of the virus or spreading false information related to the pandemic. European Union Commission spokesman Eric Mahmer says these emergency measures should not be carried out at the expense of our fundamental principles and values.
Any emergency measures must be limited to what is necessary and strictly proportionate. They must not last indefinitely. Moreover, governments must make sure that such measures are subject to regular scrutiny.
So, what's the long-lasting impact these kinds of changes have on democracy? For that, I spoke to Augusta University political science professor Craig Albert.
This is the philosophical question about democratic governance, is the issue of liberty versus security. And anytime in a democracy, when you have some type of extreme national emergency, the government and the people, as a matter of fact, tend to side towards more security than liberty. But as you just eloquently put it, when you do that, the question is, will it ever spar back, go backwards towards liberty a little bit more? For the United States and more functioning democracies, or democracies that have been so for a while, for more than 50 to 100 years, and the structure and infrastructure is more institutionalized, it's more sophisticated, the pendulum tends to swing back towards liberty a little bit as the threat descends or decreases through time. So the United States, those powers are still in place, but they're not as severe today as they were in 2002 and 2003. So the pendulum swims back a little bit. The issue more concerns less institutionalized democracies, or democracies that haven't existed for that long. They still have nationalistic tendencies. They still have authoritarian tendencies. And the idea is that strong leaders can use it as a security protocol to institutionalize those measures forever and then lessen democracy in the future. And so that's what we have to be more cautious about today, is that newly democratized nation states or democratizing nation states, this coronavirus might force them to move or allow leaders that want to be more authoritarian to be more authoritarian. And the same for more institutionalized democracies. The problem is that the public might feel that they need to be more securitized and that the country needs to be more centralized. The longer it lasts, the more that becomes the new normal. And then liberty is kind of outcast and security becomes the more political value that the citizens talk about.
If we focus on Europe and specifically Hungary with its ruling by decree for Viktor Orban there, the EU has come out and said that is something that it doesn't want to see. It wants to have scrutiny over such orders, a finite timeline. Is that kind of external criticism from a governing body outside of the nation state helpful in trying to reel things back once the immediate crisis is over?
I think that's a case-by-case determination. I don't think that'll be helpful in Hungary, where we see more authoritarian-like personalities for a while now. And when you see a newly democratized state, that type of outside criticism really pushes you towards more authoritarianism and more nationalistic, because you're pushing against the outside forces, which you view as the other in times of emergencies. So that's when identity politics, nationalistic politics, really start to come to the forefront in these types of security versus liberty and extra governmental nation states or the EU, UN forcing countries to reorganize their institutional mechanisms or their human rights. They get pushback in these instances, especially in newly democratized or institutionalized countries. So I think that's not going to be helpful for Hungary. Look for Hungary to push back against that and pretty much tell the EU to get out of its business. So I think this is going to hurt relations between Hungary and the EU.
Craig Albert is a political science professor at Augusta University here in the United States. Russian President Vladimir Putin says a referendum to change his country's constitution will go forward. The question is when. The Russian leader postponed a scheduled April vote, saying he'll wait until health officials give the okay for Russians to head to the polls without fear of contagion from the coronavirus. The proposed reforms most notably provide President Putin a legal path to extend his rule well into the next decade. But they also enshrine conservative values and religion into Russia's constitution. Charles Maines has this look at the rise of Russian conservatism and its growing influence over the national body politic.
In a town a few hours' drive from Moscow, Andrei Kononov and his family make their weekly Sunday pilgrimage. A devout follower of the Russian Orthodox Church, Kononov is also a proponent of the Kremlin's unique brand of Russian conservatism, one where devotion is defined as much by ancient Orthodox traditions as a fierce opposition to present-day Western values.
It's when people's spirituality is degraded and what's destructive is presented as normal. The problem with Western society today is that the line between what's good and what's bad is increasingly blurred.
Sister Yelena embraced the Orthodox faith long ago. Even as Soviet authorities repressed religious freedom, she dedicated her life to the church as an icon artist. She says today's Russia, under President Vladimir Putin, is an easier place to be a believer.
Russia is now an Orthodox Christian country. Our president is Orthodox. He is a person with great respect for the church.
Seeking the support of the church faithful, the Kremlin wants religious conservative values to be enshrined in Russia's constitution, with references to God and traditional heterosexual families, alongside provisions that preserve Putin's hold on power. But some observers say this may be a Kremlin tactic to overcome a lack of public enthusiasm for the constitutional changes and to generate votes from Putin's core conservative base.
This religious aspect is really provocative because quite a lot of people do not agree with the religious content in the constitution. Also, it's not clear which kind of God are we talking about, whether it's Christian God, a Muslim God, or whatever God.
Russia's Orthodox Church supports the proposed amendments, arguing they simply reflect the interest of a conservative majority uneasy about Western trends like the expansion of LGBT rights and same-sex marriage.
It can be said that the Russian population is mostly conservative. We can say that the Russian people generally support traditional values. For the vast majority of Russians, family means a union between a man and a woman.
But some clergy question the real need for abandoning Russia's current constitution, a document adopted amid democratic reforms in the post-Soviet 1990s that enshrined the separation of church and state.
I don't understand how including the word God in the Constitution can change the lives of people in a real and positive way. If we see the countries that include God in their Constitution, that does not help at all to the spiritual development of the people.
Despite concerns over COVID-19 delaying the vote for now, the constitutional changes are considered all but certain to pass, a reflection of Russia's drift towards ultra-conservatism under Vladimir Putin's rule. These days, Orthodox schools like this one on the outskirts of Moscow introduce a new generation to Russia's ultra-conservative leanings.
Any topic, any lesson, any discipline we teach to students is presented according to Orthodox values through the Word of God.
From the classroom to the Kremlin, conservative values already influence Russia's present-day political and cultural life. Now, with a vote to place religion at the center of its constitution, Russia's ultra-conservatives hope to join President Putin in reshaping the country's future. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
A growing number of Americans are being ordered to stay home in order to contain the spread of COVID-19. So musicians who can't stop playing are finding creative ways to share their music, both online and in places close to home. VOA's Julie Tabo found several Washington-area musicians who are keeping the music flowing for audiences everywhere.
The side porch of a house may seem like an unlikely place to hold a classical concert. But that's what the Milo Trio is doing. Since new social guidelines and mandates are preventing people from clustering in groups, they've taken their music outdoors and online, where people can keep their distance while enjoying a communal experience.
I thought it was absolutely wonderful. I love the selection of music. And just being here with the musicians who are performing just made me feel a whole lot better.
It was really good, really complicated music.
I thought, the music was really sweet and happy.
This is quite an opportunity to, on a weather like this, and our kids' teachers playing here, so wonderful to let them watch her and get inspired.
The trio has been together since January of last year.
We've tried to figure out some way that we could see each other, bring music to the community, and kind of satiate both of those needs.
We really enjoy sharing that music with the people around us in our community. And these outdoor porch socially distant concerts have been a great way to help build that community and help people remember that we're all still here and we're all still doing art.
Pianist Carl Banner says the response to their two concerts has been terrific.
In the neighborhood, I feel like a celebrity. Everybody stops me and says, "Oh, we loved your music." And I thought, wow.
The Milo Trio is not alone. Around the corner, Bill Crandall plays a guitar in his garage and shares it with neighbors and on social media. And across town, jazz harmonicist Frederick Yonet shares his music online and through the open windows of his makeshift studio.
You know, as a musician, you think most of your life no one cares. Now they care.
During these uncertain times, one thing is sure. When the sound of music beckons, people flock to listen on the streets of Washington and beyond. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
And that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production staff, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.